I'm Dick Gordon. Coming up, the story of a man, an immigrant from Argentina, who made his way through all the dark hallways of the U.S. immigration system over an 18-year period, and then had the most unusual opportunity to do something about changing that experience for others. Rudy Acevedo is an architect, and when the federal government went looking for someone to design new immigration centers, Rudy jumped at the chance. He put in tall ceilings, warm colors, soft carpets, lots of glass, and images of the Statue of Liberty. He wanted the immigration centers to say something.
Welcome. This is America, and this is a door that you have to go through to transform your life and to make your dreams come true.
But it didn't all come easily for Rudy. Before he got that chance, he was waiting on tables, wondering if anyone would give him a break. And someone did. I'll talk with Rudy right after the news. If you're planning to move to the United States and you're going through the proper channels and you've already filled out your G-14 information form and included your background in a G-325A form and your I-131 application for a travel document, then you're edging closer to the recorded voice of former Secretary of State Colin Powell.
Welcome to the United States of America. We are a country that has embraced foreign visitors since our earliest days. This openness has enriched our democracy, our culture, and our economy. We want you to share the American experience. We want you to come and visit. You enrich us, and we will enrich you.
Before the mutual enriching begins, though, there's more paperwork. The I-134 affidavit, the N-400 application for naturalization with its $80 biometric surcharge.
Is your destination the United States of America? Many travelers must have a visa to enter the United States. As you plan your trip, we want you to be aware of changes in visa policies that may affect your travel.
Next!
I need visa.
Where's your green form? I can't do anything without your green entry form. Go to the wall. Next! Ms. Zanworski,
yes.
You cannot get into New York without a visa. You cannot get a visa without a passport. And you cannot get a new passport without a country. There's nothing we can do for you here.
The point I'm making, and the point that's underlined in films like The Terminal, and the point that today's guest illustrates so well is that it takes a lot of determination to get here, and then it takes an equal amount of grit to succeed once you're here. But it can be done. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is produced by North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. It's co-produced and distributed by American Public Media.
Rudy Acevedo was a young man from Argentina when he came to the U.S. 18 years ago. Back then, he says, the immigration offices, where he did a lot of waiting, were not very welcoming places.
They were storefronts that rented spaces used by the government, the immigration services back then. And perceptually, there was no sense of a welcoming or warmth or even comfort because the waiting areas weren't sufficient. The parking wasn't sufficient. The areas that those buildings were located weren't the best areas in town either. They were lacking in many aspects. And that coupled with not knowing what's going to happen with your life, it's made for a not very pleasant experience. You feel a little powerless because you have absolute no control over the outcome and no chances to appeal whatever decisions are made on you and your life.
You don't want to get any questions wrong or any answers wrong.
Yeah, there are many things that you don't even know about and that can determine the outcome. It was a little bit of intimidating, and you feel not knowing is very, very unnerving.
Rudy knew why the immigration storefronts were intimidating and unnerving. The dim fluorescent lighting, the plastic chairs, windows where you have to bend over to talk to someone. It's all designed for the convenience of government employees. Rudy knew this even when he went through those buildings 18 years ago, because at the time he was already a trained architect. But even Rudy, with his optimism, could not have imagined that he'd one day be the man to help turn all that around. The U.S. Department of Citizenship and Immigration is putting up 4 brand new buildings in South Florida, and Rudy Acevedo leads the design team.
It's like I'm watching a movie. It's happening to somebody else. These kind of stories, they are really happening in real life. I'm here almost 20 years, and this is what I had envisioned when I came to this country, and everything I thought America was about is true. You know, the place where the impossible happens.
It probably didn't seem that likely in the early days after Rudy got here. He'd studied architecture in Argentina. He'd worked as a project manager in Cordoba, but all he had to show was a school portfolio, 8x11 sheets encased in plastic. He was living with a brother in Boca Raton, Florida, and looking for a job.
I went through the yellow pages in every architect's office I could call, and it was the recession of the 1990, so the architectural offices were laying off rather than hiring. Mm. And the economy, plus the fact that I didn't have any experience in the States, didn't help me to get a job. And that, it kind of it was an eye-opener for me, because I said, oh boy, I'm going to really going to have to start from the bottom. Which was okay, but it was something I hadn't expected.
Were you discouraged at all, Rudy? Were you thinking, maybe I should just go back to Argentina?
Yes and no. Yes and no. I wasn't discouraged because things weren't going according to my fantasies. But no, I don't think I entertained the going back to Argentina. I entertained perhaps going to Europe or to Spain or Italy. And even though I didn't know anybody there, but like I said, when you're that young, you feel like you're powerful to do anything you want.
So where did you finally find a job?
Out of necessity, I since I couldn't find anything in an architect's office, I became a waiter while I continued to try to find a job as close as possible to an architect's office.
You know, it happens to so many people who come to this country, and I'm always interested in how demoralizing or how discouraging it is. You have all these skills, you know what you can do, and you end up clearing away dirty dishes.
Actually, it wasn't demoralizing. I never felt it that way.
Huh.
I was happy to be doing something and happy to be sort of like on my way, and it felt like it was going to happen one way or the other. But no, I never felt demoralized.
You're a very optimistic and character.
Either that or delusional.
So what happened, Rudy? How did you make the step from being a waiter to making contacts within the architect community in Boca Raton?
That brings back to my mind the phrase that my dad used to say to me, that I always landed on my feet. And I went to work to this restaurant, Paco's Grill was the name. And the owner was Paco Castillo. And he was from Ecuador. And we became friendly. And, of course, he knew I was an architect, and he knew about my struggle. So he said, well, there are a lot of architects that come in here to lunch or for dinner. So why don't you bring your portfolio, if you have one, and I'll introduce you to when they come in. And as luck would have it, his compadre is in Spanish, sort of like a cousin. He was an architect, and he was working at the Quincy Johnson Architects back then. And he would come to the restaurant occasionally to eat. So this gentleman's name is Bill Pico. So when he showed up, Paco introduced us, and I showed him my work.
Wait a second. You say, here's your salad, and here's my portfolio. How did you do this?
No, everything was set up by Paco, and he said, well, he is an architect from Argentina, and would you be interested in looking at his work? And he said, sure. So it was pretty much like that. While he was having lunch, he was looking at the pictures I had. And
But, Rudy, what did you have to show him? You hadn't worked as a professional architect.
It was my school work, my design work from school.
He came up with his resume and folder with architectural drawings, his portfolio.
Yeah.
I looked through it and it looked really good. You know, he really was a promising architect.
What did you see, Bill, that stood out? If you can think back to what you were looking at, because Rudy told me these were drawings from school. So what was
right.
What were you looking at?
Well, they were school drawings. And, you know, at the time I was a younger fellow. I had just been out of school for just maybe 3 or 4 years. So I could appreciate what he did with the schooling that he had. I saw his work. It was great. And he had a good personality. In a few minutes that we spoke, he was a fellow that, you know, needed some boost, some help. And, you know, I was able to help him, and I did.
Bill Pico is the man who eventually hired the young Rudy Acevedo. Bill's originally from Ecuador, but he says the Latin connection had no bearing on judging Rudy's work. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. So here's Rudy, standing there in his waiter's uniform, and this guy he's never met is flipping through his architectural portfolio. What's going through Rudy's mind? I asked him if he was nervous, and he said no.
Not nervous, because, you know, you just think it's such a long shot. You don't.
Oh, you didn't think anything was going to come of this, right?
Because you don't even consider it seriously. That only happens in the movies. But like a couple of months later, sadly, the restaurant closed down like a couple of months later. So here I am sitting again at my brother's house and the phone rings and it's Bill Pico. He was calling me because there was this opening at the office as a print boy, print person, and would I be interested? And he was almost apologetic because that was all that he could offer me. And I thought I'd be delighted just to be and very, very thankful for his gesture and don't even think about being apologetic. And this is great. You know, it's one more step in the right direction.
How did the job pay? Do you remember?
$5 an hour.
So it really was kind of menial labor within an office of people who are working on design, right?
I wanted to do it so bad that I was even willing to work for nothing just to gain experience.
Did you tell him that?
yes. And I did, because actually the way it happened, he brought me into the office like for 3 days and had me draw something, do a perspective, a rendering by hand of a building they had designed and see what I could do. So I did that. And, you know, having those 3 days in an architect's office, it was like being a king for a day. And they wanted to stay. So I did actually mention, you know, I'll come and help out for free and just to gain the experience. But they didn't want to do that. If they weren't going to bring me in, it was going to be paying me.
He had a talent. He was an architect, and I could, you know, help him, and I did.
You know, Bill, that when Rudy talks about meeting you in the restaurant, he marks that as one of those turning points in his life, one of those, you know, breaks. He says it's like a movie, things you never think will happen to
you. Absolutely, absolutely. Things happen to all of us, you know. He was at the right time, at the right place. I think like him, there's a lot of people out there that come in here and work hard and that have a hope. And the way I think about it is, when people come to the United States, they're given like a blank check, and you can either, you know, cash a check for like $1,000 or $1,000,000. If you work hard, you get a lot in return. You can be successful. And I think Rudy wrote himself a huge check. Not literally talking about money, but success. You know, he worked hard for it. He's gone a long way. I think this is just the beginning for him. You know, he's a young guy and very eager, and I think there's a lot more for him.
I'll talk more with Rudy Acevedo about his move up and what it's been like to lead the design team that's created new immigration buildings in just a moment. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. There are four new buildings being put up in South Florida, buildings that will house the U.S. citizenship and immigration work that's being done there. But more important than that, they are the structures that will welcome the next generations of immigrants. The lead architectural designer is himself an immigrant, so the work that he put into opening up these structures was personal. Rudy Acevedo first came to the U.S. as a tourist from Argentina. He was a teenager, and much of what he saw then was through the window of a Greyhound bus.
I was awed with actually being here, you know. I knew of the States and through TV, through the movies, and it was a place that everyone wanted to go. And like I said, I was in awe when I got here, when I finally got to see in person what you saw on TV. And I was able to take a tour and visit New York and Washington, D.C., New Orleans, Dallas.
Wait a second. You saw more of the United States than most people who are born here.
Well, you know, when you're 18 or 19, you just go and do it.
How were you traveling?
A 7-day Greyhound pass.
And you did New York, you did Washington, you did New Orleans. What have I missed here?
St. Louis, yeah. Pittsburgh.
What was your high point of that trip?
New York City.
Why?
And the architecture, you know, being in architecture, and to be able to actually see the buildings in person that you have seen only in pictures is a pretty amazing experience, and that's what impressed me the most. And besides, New York City is, you see it in every TV show, every movie, and being there and being in front of the Empire State or the Statue of Liberty and say, wow, I've seen this so many times in the pictures, and now actually being here and being able to go inside, it was pretty amazing for an 18-year-old.
If you were to pick a moment from your time in New York that sort of stuck with you, that Mary Tyler Moore moment when you're just standing on the sidewalk turning round and round.
Well, without the twirling, I'd say being on top of the Empire State Building.
Yeah, there's nothing but city for as far as you can see.
Yes, and now looking back, and for sad reasons, the World Trade Center as well, that makes it doubly significant.
On that first visit to the United States, you were 18, 19 years old. You were already studying architecture in Argentina. Did you resolve at that time, okay, I'm going to come back here and work as an architect?
Sure, the thought occurred to me, but back then was in the realm of, fantasies or dreams that you never know if they're going to even come true or not. You barely dare to dream that far away.
Rudy did come back to the U.S., though, and he did get a job in one of the architecture firms in Boca Raton. He started as what they call a print boy at Quincy Johnson & Associates.
I would do everything that I could to help, and especially the designer, because that's what I wanted to do. Little by little, I was given more and more things to do in the design department, working on the presentations. You know, the pretty pictures that you draw, the elevations and the renderings and with the color.
And so how long was it before they had you moving into the design department?
Well, so I was at Quincy Johnson Associates like for 3 years doing the print person duties. And at the end of those 3 years, I was a full-blown draftsman and then had another job offer as a project manager in another company. And so I took the offer.
No hard feelings? Quincy Johnson didn't mind losing you at that time?
No. Quincy's been my mentor. I would speak to him and tell him, you know, I want to design. And he said the words that to this day, they were etched in fire in my mind. He told me, show me how bad you want it.
Show me how bad you want it.
Yes.
What was he saying? Yeah. Show me how hard you're willing to work. Show me how creative you can be. What was he saying?
Do whatever it takes. Work as hard as you can to get where you want to be.
Tell me something, Rudy. At that time, did the fact that you'd been trained in Argentina, did your different perspective as an immigrant help you at all? Or did you feel like you were being held back either by language or by an unfamiliarity with the American scene? How did that balance out?
It's funny that you asked me that, because yes, that's exactly the way I felt. And the fact that it was taking me so long to be hired as a designer, given the title as a designer. And I thought that was it.
Did anybody say anything to you that you recall at the time? Did anybody ever say to you, oh, you know, I mean, we've got these kids from American schools, you're really never going to make it? Was anybody discouraging to you?
Not in those terms.
Yeah.
It was that maybe sometimes it's good for your career, you know, to go change places, go to another office and then enhance your experience, and then maybe you come back and you're going to be seen differently. At this point, perhaps if you don't leave, you're always going to be seen as a print person.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Rudy Acevedo took that new job. He'd already proved to himself that he was dedicated enough to succeed. He only had to show that to other people. Rudy got a lot of experience as a designer. His new company was sponsoring him for his green card, but one day he had to go back to his old company, Quincy Johnson.
I had to go back to my old office for a letter that I needed to file in immigrations. In walks Quincy, and we got talking, and so what are you doing? And I said, well, finally I'm starting to design in this office in Fort Lauderdale. And it's like, really? Well, we are looking for a designer now. Would you consider coming back to work for us? I said no at the beginning. I said no because
perfect answer.
I was being sponsored. I had already started my process towards my green card with my other boss. I didn't want to interrupt it because if I did, I was going to have to start from scratch again. So I said no because of this and this and this. And he said, well, what if we sponsor you?
What are you thinking now? What's going through your mind?
I said, this is crazy. I thought of my dad, you know, landing on my feet. And I said, well, let me think about it. And he had me come back and for a formal interview. And since I didn't want to come back, and my conditions were kind of ridiculous at the time, and they were accepted. So I said, well, now is the time to show how bad I want it. So I made the move. And the whole time it's like I'm thinking. It is about what it means to be America, what this country means. It's like where the impossible happens and where the dreams come true. And it's all happening to you, and you know, you just can't believe it.
Rudy Acevedo soon began building an impressive new portfolio. One in particular is the clubhouse, a Spanish colonial building at the Lake Club in Sarasota, seeing it go from paper to the real thing.
Wow, this is going to be standing here long, long after I'm gone. And that is a very distinct feeling. And it's also a privilege, you know, because then you realize that what you're doing matters for other people.
What's the high point for you? Is it the time when they break the ground? Is it the time when you first start to see the walls going up? What is it?
I enjoy seeing the building going up little by little, but when you see it open to the public, it's the moment when you finally, it's like when the building comes to life.
Is this like the ribbon cutting ceremony, or do you mean when you just drive by and you see people using the building like it's part of their life?
Yes, more like that. When you're able to get into the building, enter and walk the building like anybody else, that's the moment for me.
So is that your Mary Tyler Moore twirling around moment? I don't know what you do. Do you just touch the wall, or do you just, is it the feeling of opening the doors?
No. It's just, you walk the building from the inside, from the outside, and it's just to see what you saw, and you put in paper from the beginning, and it's almost like a living thing. Like, it comes to life. And it's kind of an experience that you live internally just by looking and not touching the building, but taking it all in, the details and the history behind this roof line and this tower, these windows and the shapes and these materials.
Yeah, because you know it all, don't you?
Yeah, I had to go through all the motions.
Could you ever have imagined this when you were waiting tables at Paco's Grill and hoping to become an architect?
No, not in my wildest dreams. Even thinking back, going back to college, I'd look at the architectural record. You know, I'd look at the projects, and in the credits, you see the name such and such, AIA, that I remember thinking, man, wouldn't that be something to have those letters after my name?
That's what, the American Institute of Architecture?
American Institute of Architects.
Pretty like prestigious, then, to have that after your name.
Yeah, but that was something like a mythical that, you know, I would never dare dream. And like one of many, many, many dreams for me came through.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. 18 years ago, when Rudy Acevedo came to the U.S. as an immigrant from Argentina, he could never have known that he'd one day become the lead designer for several new immigration centers. The funny thing was that at the same time as he was imagining these new centers, he was using the old ones, trying to turn his green card into U.S. citizenship.
I had to go back to the immigration buildings because, you have to fulfill certain steps and you have to take your fingerprints and fill out forms. And, you know, throughout all this time, I had to go back periodically to these facilities.
You got to know these facilities pretty well.
Yeah, and the process and the waiting and these dingy places with the ill-furnished and ill-lit and ill-equipped for the functions.
So you're sitting there and you're feeling like everyone else who is waiting for something from the window of shame, whether it's Social Security or this piece of paper or that piece of paper. And are you looking at this place like a person who's about to get a green card, or are you looking at this place like an architect?
I look at everything, every place as an architect, and, you know, you have your critical eye for everything. I'm looking at the room I'm sitting now, and I'm taking in the furnishings and everything. And sort of the same way I look at these immigration facilities, and I'd say, you know, what a contrast to other public facilities in the States. Because, you know, when you go to the city halls, and they're nice buildings, and they are well-designed, and, you know, there is a lot of thought.
It's true. The public building, somebody spends some money on their architect. They spend some money on the construction, but maybe not so much the immigration center.
That's exactly the feeling you get. You know, it's like leftovers and second class.
Soon enough, though, Rudy Acevedo's company got a request for proposals for new immigration centers. Rudy calls it his dream project. I asked him what images he wanted to evoke in his design.
The Capitol building, the Statue of Liberty, all these images that have to do with immigration and the immigration culture and the tradition of this country, and how can all that come together in a building and convey the message through the new face of immigration. That's how my experience came into play when I first was faced with this project.
And so if the building that you were going to design could speak, could say something, what would it say?
Welcome, this is America, and this is a door that you have to go through to transform your life and to make your dreams come true.
So you would make, what, bigger doors, more windows, higher ceilings, something to make it more welcoming? How do you translate this in architectural design?
Porticos, welcoming, a kind of motioning people towards the entrance, soft glass, transparent surfaces from the outside, sort of like a suggesting permeability, not imposing, not intimidating. We are open, come in, and the proportion of the buildings, and just by making the buildings not so big and imposing would not be intimidating and discouraging people rather than attracting. And once on the inside, work with the lighting, with the materials, with the colors and the finishes to all create a feeling of, yes, of welcoming, and you are not there to be punished. You're following a process, and it's going to be served well, and you're going to be comfortable in the meantime.
What's a color that welcomes people if you have to choose a color?
Well, of course, warm colors, yellows, tans, and light pastel colors, and warm materials like soft carpeting and wood finishes.
It sounds more like a hotel than a government building.
Yes, why not?
I have to tell you, we'll have some images of the design on our website, and people can look at what you've designed, Rudy, but one of the angles, I think it's of the front lobby, it kind of looks like a modern airport, just that sense of stairways going up and people moving in different directions rather than it feeling closed down. I'm not sure, was that something that you were shooting for?
Sure, the high ceilings and the materials and the finishes. Yeah, and the airport is a good analogy because there's a lot of waiting at airports.
It's true.
And so we have to make it as comfortable as possible. And not just by that, the buildings have internet cafes, they have playground areas for kids, and because, you know, you have to face it, sometimes on some of the people, they can't afford or they don't have anybody where to leave the kids with.
You know, you put in a sushi bar and I'll just hang out there.
And well, we might suggest that for the future programs.
I want to know if in the process you ever said to the government, hey, did you know that I am a recent immigrant and so I'm bringing some of my own personal feelings into the design of these buildings?
Not put in that way, but, you know, the timing worked out that by the time that these buildings were going to be done, I wasn't going to get my citizenship. And that, of course, came up, and everybody thought it was kind of interesting. But this came up early on when we were responding to the project. That came up, and that was regarded as an interesting fact. And it's not just me. I need to say that the whole team in my office that put this building together is a group of 8 or 10 of us, half of which are immigrants.
From Colombia, different countries?
Colombia, Peru, Jamaica, Americans as
yeah,
well.
Yeah, but this is great. I mean, so you've got all these different perspectives on the different experiences of immigrant families that you can bring.
Yeah, and it was a whole team of Americans as well as immigrants that helped to put this building together, sure.
Wait a second. What was the timing between your citizenship and the groundbreaking for the building?
2 days.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. It was just a few months ago when Rudy Acevedo found those two dreams of his coming together, the ceremony when he got his own citizenship and that golden shovel moment when the earth was turned for the new immigration center.
The groundbreaking came first, and actually the next day was my interview for the citizenship, and then like a week later, the swearing ceremony.
So the groundbreaking takes place on one day, and the next day you're being interviewed, sort of like the final approval before you get your citizenship, right?
Before I get the swearing ceremony, yes.
Did you tell the person who was interviewing you that you had designed all the new immigration centers?
Yes, it did come up.
And what was the reaction?
Surprise, and they were happy for me. And the whole timing of the story is eye-catching for everyone that had to be involved in this.
So. You keep talking about the way other people saw it. I want to know how you felt about it.
It's like, for me, it's like I'm watching a movie. It's happening to somebody else that, you know, these kind of stories, they are really happening in real life. I feel very blessed and very fortunate and very touched and very humble by the circumstances that worked out this way to be able to do something that matters.
And the swearing-in ceremony, did you manage to hold it together?
Yes. But all this, what I just described, is what's going on through my mind. Wow, I'm here. I'm here almost 20 years, and this is what I had envisioned when I came to this country for, and everything I thought America was about is true. You know, the place where the impossible happens.
You can see Rudy Acevedo's architectural designs for those new immigration centers on our website at thestory.org. And if you have your own story about an unusual moment or a coming-together moment like Rudy went through, well, I'd sure like to hear about it, and you can leave me a message also at our website, thestory.org. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. A couple of weeks ago, I talked with Patsy Bates. Her story brought together two of the most deeply rooted fears that many of us have concerning our health, the fear of getting cancer and the fear that our health insurance won't cover the treatment. That's exactly what happened to Patsy. She'd recently bought herself a new health insurance policy from a company in California called HealthNet. Her application, she was told, had been approved. Shortly after that, though, she was diagnosed with breast cancer, and she had to have surgery. She didn't think she had anything more to worry about than the operation itself.
Well, that morning I got up real early and got ready, and the anesthesiologist put me out. And after I woke up, and I was, thank God, I saw live people. So I knew I was alive, so I thank God, and I woke up.
And what was the surgery? What did they end up doing?
They took off the mass.
Did they remove a large part of your breast then?
Yes, they did.
Did they say anything to you after the surgery, Patsy, about how it had gone?
The next day, the doctor came in, and he said that I could go home, you know. And then that's when he told me I needed radiation and chemotherapy. So we take the first chemotherapy. I get sick. I get very sick, so I have to go in the hospital. Then I start getting calls stating that the anesthesiologist hasn't been paid and the surgeon hasn't been paid. And, you know, people are not being paid from the insurance company. So my chemotherapy stops at that point.
You must think this is kind of strange. You've got health insurance. This is supposed to be paid.
Yeah, it's very scary because I need chemotherapy and the rest of the treatment, you know, so it's very scary.
This is the part that where I interrupted you. They said they were actually going to stop the chemotherapy at this point?
Remember, I was supposed to do 8 sessions of chemotherapy, so my chemotherapy was delayed.
What did they say? Did they say that they won't go on with this until the surgeon gets paid? What was the explanation then?
No, nobody gave me an explanation of anything.
This is a little bit puzzling for me, Patsy. At this point, you still have health insurance. Did you call the insurance company and say what's up?
I did call to find out what was going on, you know, because the anesthesiologist in the doctor's office is saying that you need to send your medical records to the insurance company. So I went and I got my medical records, and I stood there while they were faxed over to the insurance company. And I got a letter from them a couple of days before Christmas stating that they were going to rescind my insurance. This company did not want to take care of me from the beginning. When they found out that I had breast cancer, they just went through that application and tried to find something that would kick me out.
And what about the bills? I mean, back in the fall, the surgeon and the oncologist and the anesthesiologist and other people were saying they weren't getting paid. Did they ever get paid?
No, these guys have not been paid, and we still got a lot of bills. We got, I think it's over $200,000. What's the medical bill?
Still outstanding.
Yeah, they're still outstanding, and, you know, I lost, I did have a line of credit and for the business, and I had a little bit of credit, but I can't buy a shoe on credit now.
Patsy Bates sued her insurance company, HealthNet. The case went to arbitration this past November. Last week, Patsy got a call from her lawyer telling her that she'd won, and she'd been awarded $9 million. I called Patsy back at her home, and she told me she'd been at her beauty shop when she got that call.
And so I went into the bathroom, and somebody said, Patsy! I said, yes, how are you, Mr. Chernoff? He says, Patsy, we got our judgment. I'm just going to read a little bit. And I screamed in his ear. He's probably never heard anybody scream that loud in his ear.
You know, Patsy, the last time we talked, I remember thinking to myself, man, here's someone who, you know, had her health insurance taken away in the middle of treatment for breast cancer. There's no way that the arbitration judge is not going to rule in your favor. What were you thinking? Did you think you were going to win this case as well?
I was just very thankful when it was all over, you know, because they beat me up pretty bad. You know, they tried to make all this my fault and said a lot of things that just wasn't true. And then it sets a stage for the rest of people like me that have to go through this and then have to fight, you know, an insurance company. So they said that they're going to change their practices because, you know, they found it wasn't just HealthNet. Once they started looking, it was so many people, you know, so...
So what are you thinking? I mean, what's the biggest deal for you? Is it winning that $9 million judgment, or is it knowing that other people might not have to go through what you went through?
The biggest deal for me is that all of that happened to me will help somebody else, you know. When I was sick, I couldn't understand it, but, you know, sometimes you go through so other people don't have to go through all of that. You know, I went through a lot of stuff, but... You know, and all the joy is that somebody else fighting cancer or fighting diabetes or fighting heart disease that is life-threatening, you know, they got a chance now. So they won't be rescinded so quick now. And that's what's important for me.
And what about your plans, Patsy? Are you planning on going into the Praise Hair Salon every morning for the future? Going to give yourself a holiday? What are you thinking?
I went on Saturday because I felt an obligation to the people that supported me that I really appreciated. But I was kind of inundated with some crank calls and some nutty folks coming by saying some things. And I really don't know. Because I want to go out the right way, because the people that helped me the most, they could have left because at the time, I couldn't do the hair at the pace that I should have done it, but I don't know if I'm going to be able to do that.
Well, you owe yourself a rest, if nothing else.
I am. I'm just at home and just kind of resting and just thinking. You know, I've worked so hard over the years, so this will allow me to not to have to do things that I've had to do.
Well, you take care of your health. It was nice to talk to you again.
Okay. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Patsy Bates just won a landmark arbitration case against her health insurance company. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. After my first conversation with Patsy, I got a note from Terence Kelly. Terence had worked for a number of private health insurance companies. In fact, during some of his time there, he was the one who rescinded people's policies. And even with all the experience he had, he says there are parts of the Patsy Bates story that leave him perplexed, but he says there is a defendable reason to review insurance claims. He says some people just don't tell the truth, and that's where you have to start.
What do we ask? What do they tell us? And is this accurate? There has to be some reliance on honesty. You think I'm Terence Kelly because I told you. What if I'm not? how much time are you going to go through to confirm my identity? They handle thousands and thousands of these. Most of them are truthful. Just a small amount are people trying to hide something to get onto the system to have a future procedure covered.
I understand that in many cases, Terrence, you can go to the doctor and say, hey, so what's the deal with this patient? But it also sounds to me like there's a fair amount of detective work involved here. I mean, if someone has not told you about something and they move from a different city, or there's a car accident that caused a certain condition that's, you know, a few years back in their past, how creative do you have to be when you're looking at an application and trying to figure out if everybody's telling the truth?
Uh-huh. Well, I'll give you an example. A fellow came in to a hospital in Minneapolis with some type of bleeding ulcer, and he didn't speak English very well, and he related to the doctor his history. He was seen 4 years ago for this while he was living in Bulgaria and had the procedure done and thought it was cured, but it's reoccurred. Now we're going in there. So I get that history, and I get the application, and I see there's nothing in there about a history of rectal bleeding. So I move to rescind the policy.
Terrence says the guy with the policy then says there's been a misunderstanding, a confusion over language and translated answers. He insists that he was never treated for this internal disorder in Bulgaria, that it's a new condition, and he's never had the problem before. And this is where Terrence Kelly has to decide how much detective work he wants to do. He says, okay, if this guy did have this trouble before, and if he did get treatment, where would he have gone?
So on his application, he says, I was living in Pennsylvania in 1996, and it was there that I got a shard of metal in my eye, and my wife saw her gynecologist, and I was treated for pneumonia, all in Philadelphia. So I find the four major hospitals close to his house. I wrote each one of them. I said, did you treat George for bleeding, ulcer, or rectal bleeding? Sure did. The records come back to me. And the policy was ultimately rescinded because the fellow had indeed lied.
And as in the case of the Patsy Bates story, were you rewarded based on the number of policies you could rescind? Were there bonuses or incentives?
No. You wouldn't dare rescind somebody just because you wanted to rescind them. You'd have to investigate it and prove it.
Did anybody in any of the companies that you worked for ever come by your desk, a supervisor, pat you on the back and say, hey, you just saved us a ton of money. Thanks a lot.
Yes. I saved a company $1 million a year. And the president of the company put that number in the annual report. Our pre-existing department has saved us $1 million in this past 12 months. Isn't that great? Now, many of my cases, people will complain about them. They go to the Department of Insurance. And I never got a criticism that you did this wrong. And I was sued 3 times, and my attorney defeated each one of them. I never rescinded somebody that I didn't have the full boat evidence against them.
Yeah, let me ask you, though, just about how you square that in your mind. Someone puts in a policy, they don't talk about a pre-existing condition, and you say, well, look, I'm sorry, this is, you're not being honest with us, so we're not going to pay your health insurance, and we're rescinding your policy. Click. From a corporate point of view, it's probably what has to be done. But from a human point of view, what it means is someone who's sick doesn't end up with the treatment. Does that gnaw at you when you're doing that kind of work?
It's sad, but you have to have the rules and you have to enforce them. And I didn't want to get into making value judgments on very, like standing on a mound of jello. You wouldn't have a very good foundation for making the decision that this person is more sympathetic than this person, therefore we should pay this person's claim.
But surely in your review of the hundreds, perhaps thousands of cases that you looked at, that there were a number that had kind of a gray area where it was hard to know if the person did know, and it's one person's word against another. And were there times when you made a decision that made you uncomfortable because you thought to yourself, well, I've probably done the right thing by the company here, but Lord knows what's going to happen to that person who now doesn't have health insurance?
I guess I could think of people that I really felt for, but I couldn't pay them because I thought they should be paid, because I felt sorry for their circumstance.
Yeah, no, I understand that. I mean, I realize you can't reach into your own wallet in some circumstances, but I just wonder how uncomfortable those decisions would make you feel on a day-to-day basis.
I've had to reject accidental death claims. A young father, 3 young children, He was under the influence of illegal substances, and he fell out of his rowboat while fishing, and he drowned. And the policy says that you can't have an accidental death benefit paid if you're under the influence. So had to take away $100,000 from him. And that was sad. Young widow, three little kids. But I had no authority. That much money, you have your bosses looking over you, of course, yeah. And you gotta do what the boss says.
After working with the private insurance companies, Terrence Kelly took a job with the California Department of Insurance reviewing consumer complaints. He switched sides. And in this new job, he got a letter from a man whose insurance company was taking a very long time to handle a claim, even though they already had his medical records. This man wanted Terrence to find out what was taking so long.
So I wrote to the insurance company. They said, well, we're trying to get to Dr. Jones for him to release his medical records. And we want to know if we should rescind this policy because the condition claim now is a pretty severe one. Had we known this, we wouldn't have issued the coverage in the first place.
But I thought all those medical records were on file with the doctor.
Hold that thought.
Okay.
I check with the doctor. They say, we keep sending these. We sent them to him 5 times. So finally, I call the insured person back and I say, would you mind asking your doctor to mail that stuff to me? And when I got it, the doctor had photocopied his entire file, 88 pages. And in that file, I see a document that's dated about the same time that the application was made. And the cover letter is, dear doctor, we're considering this person for coverage. Please send us the records. This proves to me that this information has been in the hands of this insurance company in the underwriting file on the third floor, yet the people on the sixth floor are oblivious to this fact. They don't know that they already have the records. It's taken them a year and a half to get this far. And finally, they get the records and they say, aha, we got you on all these pre-existing conditions. You didn't tell us about your prostate problem. You didn't tell us about your pneumonia, about your arthritis, about your colitis. And boy, we're going to get you for this. And I reminded them that nothing you just told me is new.
So the way it worked out is one part of the insurance company was saying, we're not going to give this guy coverage because he hasn't told us about the pre-existing conditions, whereas all that information about the pre-existing conditions was just on another floor of the building and they weren't talking to each other.
Right, right.
So did the guy get paid or not?
You betcha. He got paid at my insistence. And then I went on to further chastise them and says, how could you let this go on so long?
Every time I read about a case in the newspaper where someone has had their health insurance rescinded or Patsy Bates that I spoke to, it always seems to me that someone is, you know, just about to get surgery and their policy is pulled, or they're halfway through medication and their policy is rescinded. And it seems to me that it's done with such a lack of humanity for that person. Why, if they're going to rescind a policy, or if they're going to say, you know, look, there's some pre-existing thing and we're going to quarrel about it, why doesn't someone from the insurance company actually go to the family and say, you know, this looks fishy. We're going to continue with the medicine. We're going to continue with the operation. We're going to continue with the treatment. But we just want to let you know that we're looking into this. And if we find there's something wrong, then we're going to stop the policy. But this, you know, someone called the hospital and said you don't have coverage. It just seems so inhuman. Could it be done that way? You've seen it from both sides.
Yeah, it could, and it just causes more confusion. You know, when they cancel them, they will say, we've spent $16,000 on your care. You've paid us $4,000 in premium. You owe us $12,000, and you are rescinded. And they create a debt, and they actually will go after them. So they wouldn't benefit if they waited till the chemotherapy was over.
Because they'd end up asking for the money back anyway.
Yeah, yeah. And then the patient would say, well, had I known that, I wouldn't have gone those extra 2 weeks for the chemotherapy. So you unjustly caused me to incur another $16,000 in expenses. And if I'd known I wasn't going to be reimbursed, I never would have got it. Some insurance companies are pretty lackadaisical about this, and they don't have proper management or understanding of how these things work. They make plenty of mistakes. They hurt people that needlessly are hurt. And what's really sad is when you find out that they were just wrong in doing it. They had no basis for doing it.
So where do you get your health insurance, Terrence?
My retirement package is pretty cool. I get it all from them for like $20 a month.
Have you read all the fine print?
You betcha. The advice you should give to people is buy your insurance 2 years ago. Don't wait to the last minute.
Terrence Kelly joined me from a studio in Omaha, Nebraska, where he now spends most of his quality time with his grandchildren. If you have a perspective to share on one of the stories that you hear, you can get in touch with me through our website. Also, if you have one of your own, I'd like to hear about it. You can find me at thestory.org or call and leave me a message at 1-888-966-9862. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is a production of North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.
American Public Media.